Number one for a reason. The best content you'll find on your radio. This is Primetime Sports with Bob McCowan on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
This song brings back disturbing memories. They always play this at Leafs games. So it's probably 3-0 right now.
Well, and you know for who.
Welcome to Primetime Sports for Wednesday, August 22nd. Jeff Blair sitting in for Bob McCowan. Fear not, he'll be back at some point. Dave Perkins is my co-host to my right.
That's who you should fear.
What? No, he's coming back. McCowan's back next week, right? Oh, the week after, right? Yeah. Okay. Oh, okay. Oh, that's right. I think Friedman's here next week.
Good man, Elliot.
Yeah, he is.
He's going to be one busy guy at the Sochi Winter Olympics. I hope he's getting his ankles taped already because he is going to be one busy guy.
Yes, I think he's probably figured that out. Ken Rosenthal of Fox Sports joins us on Primetime Sports. Hello, Mr. Rosenthal.
Jeff, great to be with both of you guys. Two of my favorites.
Oh, really? Okay. How you doing?
Absolutely. Perk, it's good to hear from you, man.
Been a long time.
Yes, it has.
So,
if I'd known you were here, I would have worn a bow tie.
Perk. Restrain yourself.
I was going to say, we all know enough about performance-enhancing substances now to know that you can't necessarily judge, a book by its cover and all that good stuff. But honestly, Bartolo cologne and elevated levels of testosterone, the two things don't necessarily go together. Beyond that, though, Ken, how much of a setback is this for the Athletics?
It is, Jeff. And the reason it is because as good as their starting pitching has been, and really it's been the best in the league, he is their one healthy veteran, and I say healthy to this point. Brandon McCarthy is another veteran, but he gets hurt all the time. He has a chronic shoulder condition, was not good in his last start, for all anyone knows, might be hurting again. They've got a number of talented young arms. You guys have seen them. I've seen them. They're great. But as you go down the stretch run here, ideally you would want a pitcher like Cologne, at least a clean Bartolo Cologne, to help you get to the playoffs.
And Ken, as far as the Athletics go, I mean, I've done some reading online in that, and I know they've sent out a release, but what do they do?
Well, they have internal options, Jeff, and that's the one cool thing about them as far as their pitching is concerned. While teams like the Jays, for instance, are scrambling for starters, and of course the Jays have had a ton of injuries, and that explains it, but the A's seem to turn up one after another. Now, they're going to bring up Tyson Ross, who's a guy that's been up and down with them. He's going to take the spot of Cologne immediately. But they just sent out Daniel Straley, who is one of their top prospects. They can't bring him back for 10 days. That's the rule. But he'll come back. And they've also got A.J. Griffin, who was very good for them earlier. He has been coming off an injury, dealing with the DL. So it's not as if they lack options. They just lack veteran options. Now, Randy Wolf was released today, and he and George Kitaris were together in Milwaukee. Oakland is a flyball ballpark. Perhaps you could see the logic there. Joe Saunders is on waivers. But I really don't expect the A's to do anything like that. I would expect them to stay internal because they believe that their young pitching is better than anything that they can get out there.
Did anybody go looking for a Bartolo Cologne website today? Or?
Well, I'm sure there is a scramble on to find that website right now, Perk.
The other thing...
As far as I know, there is no backstory along those lines, but who the heck knows what might be going on behind the scenes as we speak with this.
And the other thing that isn't impacted is they've got a pretty good bullpen out there, too.
Sure. And a guy like Cologne is reliable. Chews innings, saves the bullpen, and he's been very good all year. So there's no question that potential domino effect comes into play. But at the same time, if you would have said a week ago, oh my gosh, look at the Giants. What are they going to do without Melky? Guess what? They're doing just fine without Melky, who arguably is more important to their team than Cologne is to the A's because of their offensive issues. And yet, they won the first two games of the Dodgers series, and because they pitch so well, they should be able to stay in it and maybe even grab a playoff spot.
We're joined by Ken Rosenthal of Fox Sports. Perk, you had another question.
I was just going to say, along those lines, Lincecum coming to life last night, they must be jumping up and down to see that.
Perk, it's been really weird with Lincecum all year long. You look at him and you look at his stats. Some of his stats are rather good. Strikeout rate in the top five in the National League. Yet his walk rate also is in the top five. Pitches per inning is way up there, which indicates he has command issues. And it just seems like he has not gotten consistent all year long. Now, I believe last night, well, it wasn't a quality start, but basically 8 of his last 12 have been pretty good. The other 4 were not good at all. So there's still not that steadiness that you'd like to see. But his velocity was up last night, and he has looked more like the Tim Lincecum of old than earlier in the season. But that said, he's not throwing as hard as he once did. It's a different guy.
Ken, on the Fox Sports site right now, you've got a piece up on Steven Strasburg that I think puts pretty much into perspective what a lot of us think about this particular situation. Man, if push comes to shove, do you think they're really going to shut him down?
I do, Jeff. And the reason I say that is because they've been so adamant about it from spring training to this point. Their GM, Mike Rizzo, has been quite public about his reasoning for this. And whether you agree or disagree, the one thing I will applaud them for is their consistency. They have not wavered. Now, we can question up and down, and I have and others have as well, the logic of this and whether it is truly the right thing to do. But I do not expect them to change their minds.
Why do you think they said they were going to do it? Why not just be quiet about it and say nothing and, you know, just...
Perk, that's a great question. A lot of people in the sport are asking that. They never had to say a word. Mm. And they could have just done this. There would have been, what, 2 or 3 days of bad publicity? You guys know this. And then it would have faded. Maybe it wouldn't have faded, but you wouldn't have had a whole season of this. But Mike Rizzo, while a very good GM and has done a great job with that team, he's a guy that likes attention and likes to be out there speaking. And he basically talked himself into this corner.
Ken, we spent a lot of time yesterday talking about Roger Clemens and his comeback with the Sugarland, I believe it's the Sugarland Skeeters. It seems to me that this really is, and I know you wrote about this and you spoke about it, you're one of the first people to write and speak about it. This seems to me to be 99.9% geared towards the Hall of Fame and delaying the process, doesn't it?
Jeff, that's my take on it. And clearly Roger has not ruled out rejoining the Astros, and he is on their payroll, essentially, as a personal service contract guy. And it just seems to me that there's a lot of motivation on both sides for him to rejoin Houston. The motivation, as you said, from his perspective, is to delay the Hall of Fame clock 5 years beyond when he next retires. And by then, he'll have some separation from Bonds and Sosa and those guys on the ballot. And who knows, perspectives may soften over time. The other thing, from the Astros' perspective, hey, here's a gate attraction at a time when their team is among the worst teams I've ever seen in covering Major League Baseball. So it makes some sense on both ends. And that first day this came out, when I heard that the Astros had a scout watching him throw before he signed with Sugarland, that's when I thought, okay, this really has a chance possibly to happen. Of course, depending on his health and how he comes out of these starts.
Dave, you had
Well, I was just going to ask Kenny the question everybody's asking in Toronto. What would you do with Ricky Romero?
That's a great question. And I'm not sure I would give him another start. You might need to give him a break somehow, whether it's going down to AAA to work on some things. I don't know that that's the answer. But to see his quotes today and hear how exasperated he is and how frustrated he is, it might be time to give him a breather. And you guys have seen him much more than I, but he is a talented pitcher. This is not a guy you would expect to see struggle like this. It does happen. It happens to even really good pitchers. And they need to somehow, in my view, get him away for a little bit, then get him back and get him going again.
You know, Kenny, one of the things that that John Farrell has talked about, and I think they may be looking at doing it. I don't think they're necessarily big fans of shutting him down, but I can see them going to a six-man rotation or something like that. And essentially fixing it so that Ricky doesn't pitch as much in September as he is right now. But, you know, if you're the Blue Jays and you're looking at this situation, yeah, you know, at the same time, you're kind of obligated to put a competitive team out there because you're going to be playing a lot of wild card teams as well. I don't know what they do. Like, this is one of those few examples where it seems like every hour I come up with a different reason for them not to do something that I thought they should have been doing the hour before, you know?
No, I can see where you're coming from, Jeff. And it's funny, at the start of the year, I remember very clearly having a conversation with my colleague at Fox, who you know, John Paul Morosi. And we were talking about Romero. This was before he started struggling in a big way. And John Paul said to me, this guy is an ace. People don't know it, but he is an ace. And I listened, and I certainly understood what he was saying. And it was a reasonable debate to have at that time. And now there is no way you would call him an ace or anything like that. And I'm not suggesting shutting him down. I don't know that that's the answer. But maybe skipping a start, like you would bench a hitter for a couple of days to clear his head. That might be helpful to him. It sounds like it's mechanical, but it's got to be in his head, too.
You could also send him to the bullpen. You could send him to the minors. There's other things you do. My priority would be to think you can't have it like extend like this into next year's spring training. You can't
the minors go to spring are almost over, like Kirk. The minors are almost over.
Yeah, I mean, a month ago I was suggesting he get sent down, but even if you put him in the bullpen, you need something positive to think about.
No, I think what Dave is saying is absolutely right. And their priority next year for him, or the priority right now for him, has to be getting him straight by next year. Right. This cannot carry over. It's a great point. And when the Jays officials are meeting about this, that should be the question that they are trying to answer. How do we get him right? It doesn't matter that he pitches well in September necessarily, though you would like to see it, but how do we get him right long-term going forward?
Ken, one of the other topics around Toronto last week, and it's kind of died with a lot of the concern about Ricky Romero, but people in Toronto are watching what's going on in Boston. We know that there was some sort of dalliance with John Farrell this offseason. John Farrell is going into the final year of his contract. How do you see that shaping up? Is there any way, do you think, that Farrell's name resurfaces in Boston? It's already started a little bit, but seriously resurfaces in Boston this winter. Where do you see the Red Sox managerial situation going?
Jeff, number one, I do expect them to fire Bobby Valentine. Mm. So there will be an opening. Now, they did have that flirtation last offseason, and that's when the Jays changed their policy to say we will not allow people to move for lateral moves. They would have to go for a promotion. Clearly, being the manager of the Boston Red Sox is a lateral move for John Farrell. Now, is there any way, that's what you're asking, that he can get to Boston? And my answer would be, if the Jays decide that, guess what, John Farrell going into the last year of his contract is replaceable and we can get another manager who we think is comparable, yeah, sure, let's go get an asset for him. But, and this is a huge but, if they believe that John Farrell is a good manager and a guy who should be part of their future, they should shut this down immediately. They should sign him to an extension. And the idea, even if they don't like him, of giving him, really handing him to a division rival, because you're not getting Dustin Pedroia back for John Farrell. You're getting lesser pieces. I can't stand that if I'm the Blue Jays. I can't even live with that, because why would you help that team? You want that team down. You want them scrambling for a manager and maybe making another poor decision.
Mm. Kenny, who would be some of the other options for them? I mean, we've heard, I know Bob Nightingale's written about possibly Mike Socha. I mean, there are a lot of names out there, but that's not just any job, is it?
No, it's not any job. And Socha is an interesting name for sure, but he is signed through 2018.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't even know that he would be the kind of guy that the Red Sox would want. As you know, Jeff, they're a very statistically driven organization.
Right.
And that's not the way Socha manages.
Right.
So they would maybe have pause before hiring him. I sort of expect the next guy to be the opposite of Bobby V, more of a low-key Mike Matheny, Robin Ventura type, because those two guys, for the most part, have succeeded this season. Mattingly is another one. Bob Melvin, another one.
Mm-hmm.
Those types. Who is the next guy that fits that description? I'm not sure, but that is what I expect ultimately they will do. Not a weak person by any stretch of the imagination, but just someone who will not be what Bobby V is, this guy who focuses the attention on himself rather than the team. Now, Joel Sherman, friend of ours, wrote this week about Jason Varitek being a possibility. He sort of fits what we're talking about, right? Matheny and Ventura. He may be a little too close to his retirement and to these players to be an effective manager, but that's kind of along the lines of what I think should happen.
Ken, I appreciate you doing this as always. Thanks so much.
Thanks, guys.
Be well. That is Ken Rosenthal of Fox Sports. We used to call him Junior.
That's an interesting name. I had not thought of Veritech. That would certainly, I would imagine, go over well with the fans.
Yeah, I don't think. It's the whole thing about Jason Veritech sitting down with Dustin Pedroia to talk about something. Are you far enough removed from teammate to teammate to become the manager? But it's a great name to keep in mind.
It's a good name.
Milos Raonic is getting ready for the U.S. Open, and he's, as a matter of fact, the 15th seed for the upcoming U.S. Open. And Milos Raonic will join us when Primetime Sports continues on Sportsnet 590 The Fan, and in high definition on Sportsnet.
Blue Jays versus Tigers, pregame with Mike Wellner, tonight at 7.
Now more of what you want to hear
on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Neil probably doesn't even know the significance of playing this. Detroit Rock City. Welcome back to Primetime for Wednesday, August 22nd. While the Jays are playing the Tigers tonight, Detroit Rock City is a song that the Tigers come out to.
Great.
I'm trying to educate people about these things. I won't do it anymore. Clearly, people aren't interested. If they're not interested, I just won't do it. So Milos Raonic is getting set for the U.S. Open. He has landed the 15th seed for the U.S. Open, and we're very pleased to have Milos Raonic joining us today. Milos, thanks so much for doing this.
Thank you for having me.
I covered the U.S. Open last year. It's the first time I've covered the U.S. Open, and every now and then you go to an event and you kind of go, okay, well, that really didn't live up to the hype. It's a pretty cool event, isn't it? I mean, it lives up to being the U.S. Open, being in New York, and just the whole experience of it.
Yeah, no, for sure it does. There's a lot of things about it, but first of all, the tennis on its own is really grand and it's spectacular. But then secondly, I think it's sort of the city that's hosting it. I think it all just comes together for one great event, and it's a great event for us players because there is so much variety for us of things to do and so forth, and it's just really enjoyable.
Speaking of great events, Milos, can you talk about your Olympic experience? I mean, we all watched the match with Tsonga, that incredible 49-point game, and but how did you enjoy the experience front to back?
No, Olympics was amazing for me. When the tennis started, really, when we started competing, we sort of left the village and we were a little bit isolated close to Wimbledon because it was such a long commute away from the athletes' village. But the other days that I did get to experience, that was really special. And to be playing that well, especially with Canada on my back, it just meant a lot for me, and I'm really proud of the way I competed and so forth. I wish I could have done a bit better, but it was a great experience, and it built it up so much more that every 4 years it makes it so much more prestigious to look forward towards the Olympics.
How did it feel? Did it feel significantly different from playing at Wimbledon?
It did the first few days just because you're around so many athletes, but as soon as the competition started, you were right there on site, and it was just you stayed at the house pretty much where you stay when you play Wimbledon. So it wasn't too different. It was a little bit more more supportive and loud from the crowd, which is a little bit different to sometimes the hush-hush standards of Wimbledon, but it was definitely a lot of fun.
And Milos, I mean, that's one of the things about the U.S. Open, isn't it? When you talk to tennis players, there's a buzz there, and you know, there's not the hush you get in a lot of other places, but there really is a buzz when the competition heats up in that stadium in New York, isn't there?
Yeah, no, it's the fans here. They love to show their support for their players, and they really do push their players that they admire, and they really do put it all out there for them. And it's a lot of fun to be around that and to be around that atmosphere. It just adds to the whole grandeur of the event and how important this event is to us, and it just makes it a little bit more bigger.
Milos, after you lost in at the Western and Southern Open in Cincinnati, you had an interesting comment about you said it hurts to lose like that. It went by fast at the end. I was too passive in the second set. I needed to create more chances for myself. Can you maybe expand on that a little bit and what you needed to do to create more chances? Are you talking about moving your opponent around more, or just maybe expand on that a little bit?
I just felt like when especially in the critical moments, I felt like I was creating opportunities, but I felt there was a lot of moments where I was just a step short of creating opportunity was because I was waiting and I was sort of reacting on what he was doing. I was hoping he would make a mistake and so forth rather than myself trying to really create. And that's what I was disappointed with, because my game is to create and I didn't do that in those critical points. So I wish I could have just done that better throughout that match, but it is a learning experience and it's something I hope I don't come up and face again. And even if I do, I hope that next time around that I have the experience to deal with it and fix it throughout the match.
Hey, Milos, here's one thing I've always kind of wanted to ask you. You're known for, you know, having a huge serve, very, very hard serve, 150 miles an hour. And when you're on the other side of the net, who are the big servers that, you know, hitting
at servers, you? It comes down to probably 3-4 guys. I think you have John Isner and Ivo Karlovic, who both are great servers. But then you also, I think a lot of people don't put, and they should, Federer in that category, not just because of the serve, but also how much he can exploit you right after the serve. He creates just enough with his serve, and he does it through placement, and then he sort of takes you out of the point very quickly after. And I think another one that you can put there as well is Tsonga. He's very athletic, and he's able to do a lot with his serve. He has a lot of power and a lot of athleticism in his game.
Milos, well, go ahead, Dave.
I was going to follow up to that. You know, hockey goalies sometimes say two guys can have a shot that comes the same speed, but one of them feels heavier than the other. It's just there's a different feel to it. Is it the same way in tennis, even if two guys are hitting rockets? Does one just feel different coming at you than another one of the same speed?
And one big thing that for us is there's a lot of players that can hit very flat, that can hit close to the line, but that it doesn't feel, if you guess right and if you get your racket on the ball, it doesn't feel too hard to direct back. It's those players that make the ball, put a little more spin on the ball, make the ball bounce a little more so the ball doesn't come into your comfort zone. That just makes it a little bit more tougher. And those we have that kind of feeling when the ball is just not coming into a comfort zone where we feel comfortable hitting.
Milos, is there a part of your game, I presume in general, every athlete's game has room to grow, but when you talk about some of those things, some of the finer points of the game, is there something that you still, you're just not happy with where it is? There's something you'd like to be able to do that you're just not able to do yet?
A lot, even with my serve and many other things. I don't really get satisfied too easy, and I'm very critical of myself. But I think the one thing that we have been focusing on and putting a lot of emphasis on is not just the return, but the first balls after the return of serve, trying to be able to convert and turn the advantage onto my side as quickly as possible and neutralize the point and then sort of try to get ahead in the return games as quickly as I can.
And that's something I would think that's got to come from just repetition, experience, and competition, right?
Yeah, it comes from a lot of different things. It comes from sort of finding the way that works for you, and that just comes through doing it a lot of times, but then also learning how to deal with it in matches. And through match play is a big part of it, and you can't really simulate that in practice. It just really comes through getting out on the court and really trying to win as much and get as many matches as possible.
And even while you're gaining all this experience and self-knowledge, your world ranking keeps going up and up. So that's got to be a good thing too.
Yeah, I'm on the right track. I'm not necessarily too satisfied with where I am. I want to be further going faster and always, but try to be patient. I try to just look at it more in the sense of, am I improving and where is my level at and where do I believe I can be? And if I have that level and I will be, and the ranking will show it at the end of the year. So really, I just got to keep working away.
And even though your ranking is the highest ever achieved by a Canadian, I believe, at this point.
That must mean something. That's something I'm very proud of. But at the same time, I have a lot of pride in that. But at the same time, my parents always taught me, especially because there hasn't necessarily been a great tradition in Canadian singles in tennis. My parents always taught me, don't compare yourself with other Canadian players. Compare yourself with the best in the world.
With Milos Raonic on Primetime Sports. Milos, before we let you go, one of the things that always kind of interests me about high-performance athletes, guys who play in an individual sport a lot, is how do you find a balance between maintaining the the technical aspect of your game and maintaining your overall physical fitness? I mean, do you alter your routine during the year, or, you know, how is the balance? Will you set aside a certain amount of time each day where you'll work out and then have recovery time and then work on your game? How do you divide the labor there?
It's really a day-to-day thing. It all depends on how I'm feeling and also what my coach and my fitness trainer see that needs to really be stepped up. And you don't feel perfect every day. There mm-hmm. might be weeks where you feel a little bit slower than other weeks. And those weeks maybe focus a little bit on the agility off the court rather than just trying to create it on the court. And there might be some weeks where you might be struggling a little bit with just your timing and your feel, where you have to spend more time just playing and hitting a high volume of balls. So it really just varies all the time. And it's why I have the team around me that I trust, that I know that they're looking out for what's best for me, and they'll give their advice to me to really create as many opportunities as I can to win.
Milos, I appreciate you doing this. Thanks so much. Stay healthy, and best of luck at the U.S. Open.
Good luck.
Thank you guys very much. Nice to be here.
Take care. That is Milos Raonic ahead of the U.S. Open. He will be the 15th seed in the U.S. Open, and I didn't see the match in the Olympics. I was covering another event. But I caught a little bit of it and was following it on Twitter. And that is one thing about tennis. Bruce Arthur's a guy who is a huge tennis fan. He always tells me that he thinks tennis is in a golden age right now. And there's certainly do seem to get a lot of classic matches these days.
Yeah, there's been some tremendous matches. And there's wonderful players, men and women, out there. That Olympic match was really something. It was to the point, I remember I was in here a couple of weeks ago and we were talking about it with Damian Cox, mm-hmm. who's a tennis junkie, and he said he thinks the Olympics will now adopt the regular tiebreaker system to stop this insanity of, you know, guys playing on forever.
Yeah, because the one thing about the Olympic competition is you've got a compressed time frame. You got to get a lot of games in.
Sure.
And at the same time, you sort of want to stay true to the rules, but it does make sense that they would do that. And we appreciate Milos Raonic joining us. We're going to take a break, and we'll be back with more. This is Primetime Sports on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and Sportsnet.
OHL Commissioner David Branch joins Brady and Lang tomorrow morning at 8:05. Now more great sports talk on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
So that's it. We're back. Welcome to Primetime for Wednesday, August 22nd. Jeff Blair sitting in for Bob McCown. Dave Perkins, my co-host. I know this song, too.
I don't have my headset on. I don't know what song it is.
It's by Sublime.
Oh.
Next. I don't know the title. I just know it's...
Next.
Yeah, it's Santeria. That's right. It's Santeria.
Now, I know I'm only an interloper here and
what?
Whatever, but... You just bored the hell out of me for about 8 minutes talking about your soccer pool.
I did not.
Your some fantasy soccer nonsense. And here's a word of advice for you and everyone else. The last thing in the world anybody cares about is somebody else's fantasy league team. All right? No one wants to hear it. Go do your nerd thing, and that's fine, and that's good, and you gather with the other nerds and everything. But
you play fantasy sports.
30-odd years ago, we did the first one. We used to do baseball one when we had to, believe it or not, we had to do all the stats by hand out of the sporting. Get this, Al Ryan and three or four of us would go to the Pilot Tavern on Thursday night with a fresh copy of the sporting news, which had the statistics up to the previous Sunday, and work it all out by hand at the bar. And that's how we did. Now, of course, it's too easy.
You know what? You know,
everybody knows everything. The information is so good on fantasy stuff. I wouldn't find it any fun.
I've even been told that there are shows devoted to fantasy sports.
Yeah, well, it wouldn't surprise me. I mean, you know, the nerd factor multiplies by itself, you know. But there is so much information out there now. It's, if you want to do that kind of stuff, and my son does it, and he quite enjoys it, it's great. But it was kind of more fun in the old days when we had to do it by hand at the Pilot.
So who are the guys? I mean, Milson must have been involved, was he?
I don't think Milson was. It was mostly star guys back then, but Al Ryan and Garth Woolsey and, you know, Jerry Hall and Phil Bingley, people like that. We'd end up with, you know, the dregs list, you know, which was the guys not drafted. Anyway, okay, nobody wants to know about fantasy. Everybody plays fantasy. I think the CFL would do well to get a fantasy football thing going to bump up fan interest, because they clearly bump up fan interest. I think there's a generation of people out there now who, you know, they're fans of everything now because of it. They're not just, you know, we grew up, the kids, you wore either a Leaf shirt or a Canadian shirt when you were a kid, right? Because that's all there was. And the real exotic people would get a Boston or a Chicago.
Or a Red Wings. Some of us had Red Wings jerseys.
That was pretty exotic to get that. But now you can watch any game you want anytime. You can, you know, you're a fan of whatever your rotisserie team is, your fantasy team is. You got a guy on Houston, a guy on San Francisco, and a Blue Jay, and a Yankee, whatever, you know.
No, it's changed the way people, totally changed the way people cheer and how people follow sports.
It changed the way we watch sports. I mean, look at the NFL games on Sunday, where the networks now have tickers across the bottom. You know, Joe Blow in Philadelphia just scored a touchdown, and, you know, somebody else is hurt, and it has increased injury awareness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I'm sure that there are 100,000 people across North America bouncing up and down because Yunel Escobar is going to have a baby, or his wife's going to have a baby tonight, right? He's going to miss 3 days, I think.
Yeah.
So they're all sticking their shortstops in. Too much information.
All right. Well, here's what I want to know. Because you're a person who likes the odd punt, right? You like to place the odd wager on on events.
Yes.
Okay, what's the difference between doing that and fantasy sports?
Well, I don't follow.
Well, I mean,
you mean I bet a football game or a horse race or something?
Because essentially you're looking down on people who are involved in fantasy sports. And
I'm not looking down on anybody. I'm just saying, no one wants to hear about somebody else's fantasy team.
Got four goals in one match today?
You got four goals, what's that, a month?
No.
A week?
Hold it.
A day?
I got three. I got, what happened to the other one?
All right.
Oh, I guess I thought I had four. I thought I had four goals.
Well, congratulations. Do you feel better?
Well, I do, as a matter of fact.
Will dinner taste better?
No.
No.
No, it won't. It won't taste better.
There you go. Not like winning a bet, then you go to a better restaurant, you see?
Yeah, no, that is true. That is true. But, when you were covering baseball, I can remember the dialogue with fans changing probably, I want to say it was in the, it was probably even maybe later in the 90s, I first started noticing it in the late 90s when you'd talk to fans and stuff would move away from sort of something to do with the team to something to do with individual players.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I mean, you'd go out in a bar or something, you'd run into somebody, and it was always, hey, the Expos need to blah, 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 or blah, blah, blah. Then it kind of became, you know, Pedro's, you know, his whip needs to be.
Yeah, yeah. People were, when I was covering the Blue Jays when they were very good, you know, in the late 80s and early 90s. And people don't realize this now in Toronto, of people of a certain age, but the Blue Jays were bigger than the Maple Leafs ever were.
Yeah.
And the Jays controlled the town. And I worked for the Toronto Star, and I would get, at the peak of the season, I used to tell people this, I would get 30 letters or phone calls a day. Letters. Mm-hmm. People would have to write it out, lick a stamp, walk down to the mailbox and mail it. There was no email. There was no instant, you know, communication mm-hmm. type of deal. And virtually all of them were baseball related. You know, they wanted so-and-so in the bullpen, and how come so-and-so didn't bat third, and why don't they bring up Joe, you know? Mm-hmm. And it was all very heartfelt stuff.
Yes.
It wasn't like now where everyone sucks or everyone rules or, you know, three-quarters of them are obscene, the emails and threatening and you know, like there seems to be a lot more expressed anger now.
Mm-hmm.
That comes in to people. Yeah, I'm sure you get it. You know, communication is so instant, so easy, and so anonymous. I mean, in the old days, you used to have to put a,
yeah,
you know, if you didn't have a return address on the envelope, I used to throw it away.
Right.
You know, because you used to say anybody who wasn't willing to identify their opinion doesn't have one worth listening to.
Mm-hmm.
But things have certainly changed that way, and it was... yeah, it started with the rise of the internet in the 90s, but it used to stun me how much heartfelt mail there was from mm-hmm. people about the ball team and, you know, and
yeah.
what should happen.
No, I mean, I used to get the same thing when I was in Montreal as well. It would be remarkable. And usually once the season was over, you kind of knew that about a week after the season was over, you're going to start getting a ton of mail from people. Just, you know, don't like what happened here. Don't like this. They got to do this for next year and everything. And it is. And, yeah, it was just, it was a lot more, I guess it was a lot more studied in a lot of ways, or maybe a lot more studies, probably not the right word. It was probably a lot more heartfelt, I guess.
I think now it's a lot more, analysis is way more statistically based.
Mm-hmm.
There are so many statistics, good, bad, and otherwise, so many advanced statistics that simply didn't exist 20, 30 years ago. You know, you had to used to watch the games to know what you were seeing. Now, you know, watching the games still a great part of it, but it's only part of it because there are certain truths that reveal themselves apparently in statistical analysis.
Who was the first guy you covered where you remember being really, really taken by statistical analysis? Joe Carrigan was when he was the Expos pitching coach. I mean, Richard Griffin can confirm this. We used to go out in a bar, and quite often, frankly, with Carrigan. And Carrigan would start talking, and Griff and I would look at each other like, huh?
Jimmy Key was a big stats guy. I know Key
really?
was a big stats guy. He was very analytical.
Mm-hmm.
And Key used to, I remember one time, Key and two or three other pitchers, it wasn't just him, said, because I used to keep weird statistics, you know. Mm-hmm. On things. And Key said, why don't you keep a book on the number of triples down the left field line we give up? That's the year that one of the years George Bell was in left field.
Mm-hmm.
So the pitchers were very aware of that kind of thing, you know. Yeah, there was, it wasn't just him, but there was he seemed to know what was going on everywhere in the league.
Yeah.
You know, he always knew who the hot hitters were and this was long before, as I say, the internet. But there was a great point.
That was funny. I was going through the basement last week, and I found one of my books. And people of a certain age, I don't want to sound like two old guys sitting here reminiscing.
That's
but people, yeah, people of a certain age aren't going to realize this. But, I mean, it used to be hard to get updated stats all the time. So you used to keep a book, and basically you would have you know, Tim Wallach, you put the date down, what he did, how many hits he had, and you do that the whole year. You would keep it up the whole year. You'd try to catch, you'd have that one day on the road where you got behind, you'd clip out the box score, stick it in the thing, and I was going through and I saw this, and it wasn't that late, it was from like 1989 or something like that. And I'm going, God, now I just go on the internet and go, Tim Wallach.
The information immediately.
Yeah.
It was great. I used to keep a book on umpires' ERAs.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there'd be 15 major league games a day. It was okay. You missed a day or two, yikes, now you were really scrambling to catch up. It was a lot of work, and as you say now, it's so much easier. And the information's way better now than it used to be back then.
Milson used to keep, Larry Milson used to keep track of national anthems.
Yeah.
Length of anthems.
Yeah. Larry would run the occasional pool, too, on length of national anthems, I think.
Yeah. Well, anyhow, things have certainly changed.
Things have changed.
Things have changed. We're getting old, Dave. You know that.
Define we.
Yeah, it's true. Probably shouldn't say that. Charlie Casserly, one of our favorites from the NFL Network, is going to join us. We're going to talk about a lot of things. Michael Vick, obviously. Andrew Luck is impressed so far. We're also going to talk about replacement referees. I mean, a lot of people, I don't know if they're aware of this or not, but the NFL still doesn't have a deal with its officials, and we'll talk to Charlie about replacement referees and what may be in store there. Steve Bitker from KCBS in San Francisco will join us. We're going to talk about the Bartolo Colon suspension. And maybe George Larac will join us. Maybe. It's a big tentative beside it, but we'll keep our fingers crossed. The network joins us when Primetime Sports continues on the Fan Radio Network and Sportsnet.